Let's get to it. To it. To it. To it.
Hey, thanks for listening to Almighty Ball and the Almighty Podcast on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Chris Axman, and I'm here today with Josh Lloyd of the Red Rock Fantasy Basketball League / Locked On Fantasy Basketball. Josh, how are you doing?
Hey, Chris, how you going?
Pretty solid. You know, I'm just about done with this move-in, man. I just went into this loft. It's been a saga. You know, for you listeners out there that have been there step by step to auditorily witness it, it's almost coming to an end, and like, I'm excited for that. So,
yeah, there's nothing more annoying than moving stuff around.
Oh my god, dude! I decided that it was a good idea about, I think, a month before I moved to get like a 5-month-old puppy, you know, and then I decided on top of that it was a good idea to name said puppy KD, named after Kevin Durant. And then a couple weeks right into having her, Kevin Durant gets traded to the Warriors. And I think that she's different now, honestly.
Just she's been affected by real life decisions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I feel like, so she still has an OKC collar, right? And she still has an OKC food bowl and stuff. And I think that has something to do with it. And it's funny because, like, you know, I got a Golden State Warriors chew toy. You know, and now it just doesn't quite feel right, you know. But anyways, yeah, Josh Lloyd, Red Rock Fantasy Basketball, but you just joined the Locked On Podcast Network. They're doing a great job. I just had Philip, the host of Locked On Magic, on, and before that, I had Locke himself on to talk Jazz. But today we're talking fantasy basketball. Before we get down to brass tacks, where can our listeners find you on Twitter, Facebook, and, you know, across the net?
Okay, so Twitter is redrock_bball. Facebook is facebook.com/redrockbasketball. You can find the podcast by searching Locked On Fantasy Basketball. It's on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and TuneIn and anywhere where you can podcast. And all my work and fantasy projections is on basketballmonster.com.
Yeah, definitely. And do that. And you're really good at the start of your podcasts on saying and like making it compelling and personal, like, you know, go give us a 5-star rating, you know, it helps us a lot to do that. I'm not nearly as good at that as you are. Would you do me a favor and ask my listeners, like, hey, you know, go ahead, give Almighty Ball on a 5-star rating, you know, just like plug it in instead of Locked On Basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone who listens to this podcast, you know what Chris is about. You know what the Almighty Ball is about. It takes you maybe not 5 seconds. It takes you 30 seconds. Head across to iTunes, leave a review, and you know what it does? It helps to bring these podcasts more attention, and therefore more attention means better quality, better guests, better content. So everybody wins, and it's free for you to do. Go and do it. I've done it, and I'm sure everyone else here will join in and do it as well. It is the best way that you can support any podcast by going, giving a 5-star ranking, and then leaving your comments below. Make them funny, make them informative, make them whatever. Just do it.
Wow. Wow, that was stupendous. I've got a pretty good brown nose thing to say, right? I have this feeling that you're not the guest that I have to butter up, but, you know, that being said, I was going to say, it's like, help get, you know, better quality, better guests. And I was, you know, if you were a different human, I would have said, but there's nowhere to go but down, you know?
there's plenty of other ways to go, up from me. But I think I appreciate the attempt.
I could go like down and to the left, like diagonally, maybe like an asymptotic thing, you know, up and down anyways. So, you know, I don't actually play fantasy basketball, and, you know, that's cool. And I think, you know, if anything, fantasy basketball is just another take on basketball, like analytics, like X's and O's, and like, you know, even if you just play NBA 2K, if that's how you started out and that's your understanding of basketball, it fits into the larger piece of the puzzle. And what I found, right, by listening to your podcast and sort of continuing to consider dipping my toe in the water as far as playing fantasy basketball, I found increasingly that you know, you can't have an understanding of fantasy basketball without having, you know, a much more than rudimentary understanding of basketball and how it works. So I would think that that's somewhat implicit, but bringing that another step, where do you think the shortcomings happen there, right? Because I think that the analytics-driven approach sometimes hits certain walls. Say you get too deep into the numbers and maybe you have chemistry problems with Harden and Howard, right? Or, you know, if you're just purely X's and O's driven, maybe you make a lot of the mistakes that Doc Rivers does. When you're conceptualizing the game, what do you think a purely, or not even purely, but have you started to notice what your shortcomings are as far as like breaking things down, or maybe just your colleagues too in fantasy basketball?
It's a good question. It's part of it. But I think what you touched on initially is probably the major part, is that you can't really be heavily invested into fantasy basketball. You can't really be heavily invested into talking about it without actually loving the game and understanding it beforehand. So it's not like you just come in saying, I like fantasy, therefore I'm going to start doing basketball and go from there. Because if you do, then you're gonna fail, because you're not going to be able to do it. So you have to have an understanding. And so much of fantasy is being able to scout players and understand psychology involved with how teams may approach rotations, how coaches may approach their personal preferences towards players as well. So you can look at things and go, okay, I'm looking at it on a purely statistical basis. And in the end, that's how the outcome of it is. But I think that the way that I approach doing it is that I've got to look at it all from a holistic view as well. So I can come in and I can say that I think that John Henson is a really good player and he's being underused and he's a really good rim protector. But then I've also got to say, I know that Jason Kidd refuses to play him. And I know that depending on, look, his numbers are great. He might block 4.5 shots per 36 minutes and they're great numbers. But I've got to also have the thing as well, Kidd's not going to do that. He's not going to play him 30 minutes. He's of the mindset that either A, he's not good enough to be in a bigger role, or his effectiveness dips after playing 20 minutes. So you have to understand all those things. Now, some other people, I'm not trying to.
Wait, time out. Okay. I remember, so my guests, right? I have this great thing. I'm a great host, and I'm a great host because the people who I have on, I've listened to their podcast for a while. I remember like 6 months ago, you said that you think that Jason Kidd doesn't like John Henson because John Henson is maybe sleeping with his wife.
Yeah, that was that was me trying to rationalize what's going on. I said, look, anything could be happening, because it is clear that he doesn't like him and he hasn't liked him for 3 years. That is definitely maybe it's the Derek Fisher syndrome.
But, you know, I totally interrupted you. Do you remember your train of thought?
Not really. I was mainly just talking about you asking shortcomings in what I do. And look, some of it is you're looking at the output of numbers, and some of that does translate maybe to the defensive ability of players, where in fantasy the defensive ability of players is basically just rounded into their ability to get steals and blocks, and that's not a indication of how good a player is defensively. But I do make a concerted effort to really get into look at how a player actually is defensively, and then try and translate that. Say a guy like, example, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who's been a really good perimeter defender, but it's never translated statistically. And it's like, this guy's a good defender. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, top 3%, 4% in terms of wing defenders, you could say Kidd-Gilchrist is, but in terms of fantasy defensive stats, they're terrible. But it's more like you've got to look at these things and say, hey, maybe it's going to flip. Maybe then the steals will start coming.
Did you see that Kidd-Gilchrist was on Woj's podcast?
I've got it downloaded. I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm really interested in listening to it, because Kidd-Gilchrist is a guy that really intrigues me. I know he's gone through a lot of stuff, and he's a very shy sort of guy. He's had a lot of issues with stuttering, I believe, and that's affected his social abilities growing up. Really good to see him flourishing, and I can't wait to listen to it.
Woj is interesting. I think typically this is sort of off-putting to me. He very sort of blatantly tries to lead listeners to certain conclusions. So like what I'm talking about is, do you mind if I spoil a little bit?
No, go ahead.
He connects his sort of shot devolving while he's at Kentucky with the stutter thing. That's what he sort of tries to imply, that there's a mental connection there where the little tweak that happens vocally or in speech patterns, that as his shot went to go off little by little more, that it was sort of like cognitively associated with one another. I thought that was really interesting.
Okay, I've definitely, yeah, that's, there's so many different things that could be attributed to it, but I reckon Kyogre is a very interesting character.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so, you know, one thing that I'm trying to avoid with this whole conversation is like just sort of having this be my token fantasy basketball podcast, right? Because you're really the guest that I've had that is a fantasy basketball oriented guy. But since I don't listen to you as like, okay, I'm trying to like know how I'm going to win my daily fantasy basketball game or whatever, I sort of wanted this podcast to sort of be more of a chance for you to just put that aside and just try to talk hoops. You know what I mean?
And yeah, absolutely. Like,
yeah, yeah. So
I do. Look, my podcast is fantasy basketball related, and during the season it's pretty heavy that, but in the off season I do lots of stuff that's not fantasy related. I go on other podcasts that aren't fantasy related. I do other writing that's not fantasy related. So look, I look, there's a massive crossover between the two, and I'm comfortable switching between the two, no problems. No, you didn't. It's all good.
But yeah, I mean, that was more for the listeners than anything, because like I introduced you as like fantasy basketball or whatever. First off, starting off, so what personally gets on your nerves? Because you know, I think people have these things that teams will do in terms of building or coaching or the way that they put together a team that personally really bother them. And I think the three most bothersome, sort of infuriating off seasons, what makes you more upset, Chicago, New York, or Indiana? What just touches a pet peeve more?
It's a very biased answer you're going to get because I'm a Bulls fan. No, so it's clearly Chicago. Yeah, that bothered me a lot. But if I'm trying to take personal bias out of it, it's still Chicago. It was just it was just contradictory, and that's what really really gets on my nerves. Or to come out and I was all for the Rose deal. I was all for, okay, let's move on from Gasol. Let's move on from Noah. I understand it, all the reasons behind that. I understand it. There was going to be some short term pain. And they came out with the right comments. We're going to get younger. We're going to get more athletic. Let's give it to Jimmy. Let's develop some players. Let's get some young guys in. Mirotić, Portis, Valentine, Grant. All these guys have a chance to develop and become. And we saw the Summer League squad, who they gelled really well. Felicio, all those guys played well. Yeah. And then you go and bring in two guys who not only are old in Wade and Rondo, not only are not athletic anymore in Wade and Rondo, but also they do their very best work by taking away the strengths of Jimmy Butler, who's their best player. And it just makes very little sense. I understand what they're trying to do in their head. We want to stay relevant. We want to make the playoffs again. But to what end? It is just a baffling sign of a team with no direction.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I recently did my Indiana team preview. That was my argument for why I thought that the Indiana moves really shot them in the foot, is because it's not even that Jeff Teague isn't a good player, because Jeff Teague is really good, you know?
He's good, yeah.
Montrezl is kind of, like, by NBA standards, bad, you know? If you want to be diplomatic, you know, he is top 450 players in the world by definition, but by NBA standards, he's, like, bad, probably shouldn't play more than, like, 10 minutes a game. But the more that Jeff Teague and Montrezl are on the court with Paul George, as long as that's your starting lineup, you're taking away that sort of superstar thing. It takes away that LeBron Cavaliers thing where, you know, when the rubber hits the road, LeBron can just, you can put the ball in LeBron's hand no matter how crappy his teammates are, he can make something happen. And you're just sort of siphoning that from the team, and you're taking away the Paul George and Jimmy Butler star effect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and I'm glad you brought up Indiana, because I've had, you know, friendly discussions with people on Twitter about the Pacers. People saying, oh, the Pacers have made these moves, they're going to be a two seed. I go, you know what, I reckon they're worse than last year. And I think you agree, because Alice will take the ball, and Teague needs the ball as well. And George Hill's a better point guard to me than Jeff Teague, even though he might not have the same stats. He was never an all-star, but what he did with Indiana, and when it was his time, he could grab the ball and he could just be dominant. But when he didn't need to, he can sit off and he'll knock down 41% of his threes. Jeff Teague, he shot a really good percentage from three last year, but He's never, ever done that before, and he's never shown any sign of being an above-average three-point shooter, and I don't believe that that happens again. And it's just a weird mix. Al Jefferson makes them slower, and Larry Bird's been, let's get faster, and Al Jefferson slows everything down. Not that he's going to be a starter, although some people think he will, and they're wrong. It was a weird decision.
Actually,
I think they
probably
got worse.
Will end up starting, but that's...
Do you?
Oh, yeah, well...
I think there's zero chance he starts.
So I think that what's going to end up happening is that Miles Turner is just going to get abused and potentially foul out 25 minutes into the game if he really has to play center. And, I mean, Miles Turner at this stage of his career, I think he's going to be a rim protector eventually, but right now I think he's a weak side shot blocker, which is why the defensive pairing of him and Jan Mahimi works so well. So I think, like, what's going to happen is that's going to be increasingly realized by Nate McMillan, and he already has a tendency in the past to go towards two big lineups. Maybe I'm projecting that onto this Indiana core, but I figure they're at least going to have a, you know, so Paul George is, of course, a huge plus defensive player, and Miles Turner, if he's playing weak side shot blocker, if he's being Serge Ibaka, he's a plus defender. So at least in that case, you can have two plus defenders. And actually, I think if you have Al Jefferson, there's an interesting effect where it's almost like he's like a scarecrow and Miles Turner can kind of come out of nowhere.
Okay, so you're thinking Jefferson and Turner start together.
Right,
put Thad Young on the bench.
Yeah.
Okay, so the people that I was speaking to were like, now Jefferson's going to start, Young's going to be the four, and Turner's going to come off the bench. Jefferson's not a good Turner's a better defender than Jefferson is now. Jefferson's knees are done. He's too big. He's too slow. I don't think that he can physically play more than 23 minutes a night.
Yeah. I just feel like the times when you want to play Miles Turner at the center is not against starting centers. You know what I mean?
I was very high on Miles Turner coming into last season, so I've got a more inflated opinion of him. I think he's going to take a huge leap forward this year. I think he's going to be really, really impressive.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the problem with the narrative. Is like, I'm not saying that he's bad, because I probably think that he's better than the general narrative. I'm just saying that, I mean, as a sophomore, and as a sophomore who is sort of skinny, and as a sophomore who, on top of that, is foul-prone, playing the center, playing primary rim protector is problematic, you know, and I don't think that that's defensively, I think that he's a defensive liability as opposed to a plus, you know, and it's like, there's only so many players in the league, maybe 10, who are like plus weak side shot blockers, you know, like the whole Ibaka thing. And I think Miles Turner is that, you know, I think he's a great example of it. And if you slide him to the five and try to have him defend fives, I just feel like that's a misutilization, I guess.
Well, let me phrase it this way too then, and maybe concentrating more on the Eastern Conference, but which centers in the Eastern Conference are good enough that are really going to give him problems? Boogie Cousins is going to give him problems, definitely. He's going to play him twice in the year. Like, Cousins gives everybody problems. Who else as a center is going to give him big problems?
You see, my concern is more in pick and rolls. I'm concerned about, like, John Wall.
Yep. Okay. But he's a lot faster to recover than, say, putting Jefferson in that spot.
Yeah, but if you're playing Jefferson like 23 minutes a game, and if Jefferson gets sort of into foul trouble, that's okay. And also, Miles Turner as a weak side shot blocker is a real thing. You know, I mean, it's like Serge Ibaka is a real rim deterrent, even not as a center. You know what I mean? And if anything, it's at least an interesting thought experiment to think like, okay, if you're incentivizing people to take it right at Al Jefferson, who's not a good defender, having a really good weak side shot blocker, that could work, maybe. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I just feel like, you know, Thad Young, the last thing they need in the starting lineup is like another 30% career three-point shooter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so can we agree that they got worse this season?
Yeah,
Or maybe they didn't get as better as what people think they did.
I think that they're worse than Chicago, actually.
And I would say that the coaching downgrade is significant as well.
Yeah, well, and that remains to be seen. I don't dislike McMillan.
Neither do I. I just think he's a downgrade.
Yes, that's definitely true. I think that people... It's like everyone understands and says, like, Vogel, great defensive coach, and, like, totally. But he's great defensive coach, as in he started something in the same way that Thibodeau started, okay, this is how we're going to play a strong side zone or a weak side zone. Like, he sort of revamped the way that you play zone defense, Tibbs did. And then now Frank Vogel with Paul George, like, the whole roaming free safety three, that started with him and Paul George and Indiana being the best defense in the league year after year after year. And now Kawhi Leonard's doing that. And Alfred Gamino's doing that. And Jay Crowder's doing that. It's maybe the most effective defense in the league. So Frank Vogel is, like, straight up probably, I mean, it's either him or Tibbs, like, innovative, that level of good. So, and I mean, what I was going to say on top of that is, you know, it takes time to implement a new system too. Last year, the Thunder probably were better than their win total, right? But, like, if the Pacers are already, I mean, they barely made the playoffs, and then I think that they took a step back, right? That 10-win difference by implementing a new system is a big deal, I think. You know what I mean? Yeah,
and especially given that section of the Eastern Conference behind the Cavs, and you got the next two teams, but the guys from, say, 4 to, like, 13, it's really close. Like, the Bulls missed the playoffs, the Wizards missed the playoffs, and they both should be better. As much as I hated the Bulls offseason, they should win an extra one or two games or three games. That puts them into playoff contention. The Magic have done everything they can to try and be better. Whether they actually are, I don't actually know at this point. But the Knicks have done everything to get themselves into contention for the 8 seed. Again, who knows whether it worked. But between 4 and 13 in the East, it's very much like, let's just push all these guys together, and who knows how it's going to work out.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it's correlated to the big thing that happened. You know, the salary cap projection was pushed back because there was so much money spent. It's because literally every team in the Eastern Conference, except for two, you know, the Nets and the 76ers, everyone else was like, we have money, let's go for the playoffs, you know? And, like, that normally doesn't happen. But, yeah, I mean, it's not like there's 13 teams that are playoff or bust, but there's 13 teams who fully expect themselves to get in the playoffs. And, like,
yeah, that's the way. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So if we're saying that all of those teams improved and the Pacers barely scraped their way into the playoffs last year anyways, just mathematically, they don't make any sense. They have to take a huge step back defensively, right?
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah, and then offensively, like, they just have way too many inefficient players, right? So I think they'll be very inefficient, like top of the league inefficient, right? And that was okay for the Blazers last year because they had so much other stuff going on that the Pacers aren't going to have. So it's like, I just think their defense is going to bottom out, like, just totally. And then their offense is going to be just totally inefficient. It'll be fast-paced, but, like, all right, you know?
For as good as Paul George is, he's not the most efficient player either. He shot less than 40. Yeah, for a guy that was playing the four, to shoot less than 42% from the field, he didn't play the four all season, but he played there some, and to shoot less than 42%, it's not efficient.
Right. Monte Ellis, I don't even need to get started on that. Yeah, Jeff Teague, know that. People want to say, like, okay, Jeff Teague, like, he shot, like, 40% last year. Like, has there ever been an offense as spread as the Hawks last year? Like,
yeah, and
I mean, they're
everybody
five
should
out.
Be worried. Everybody should be worried about any player that leaves the Hawks. Everybody should be worried about it because, and this is the example that, and you may have heard me say this on the podcast before, is that Damari Carroll was a nobody before he came to Atlanta.
Oh yeah, you talked about this on your last podcast.
Yep, terrible. He was no good. Him, and then,
but just because you got good value, yeah.
Exactly. But then he went to Toronto and it remains to be seen what he does, but he had a knee injury. But before that knee injury, he also wasn't good, and his shooting percentage dropped significantly. And it had dropped before he had the injury, and it was terrible after he had the injury as well. So there's that. But there's a real chance that playing in that Hawks system with the ball movement and with those five guys they had as their starter really bumps guys up, and we might see Teague really fall off when he doesn't have, you know, Al Horford and Paul Millsap is the two bigs who can just move the ball around and do everything correctly.
Yeah, well, I mean, the bottom line, right, is that Jeff Teague, I think if you had the Hawks starting lineup, is Jeff Teague the least threatening three-point shooter in that starting lineup?
Last season, yes. Like, before that, you would have said Horford, but Horford turned into a more threatening guy. And it also helps when you're playing again. You're playing next to Kyle Korver, who is one of the greatest shooters of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, I'm sure you know this as well as I do. I mean, even a guy like Dwight Howard can nail threes in an open gym. Yep. It is so much more different. It's like there's a huge difference between shooting wide open and then shooting not wide open, right? Already, he wasn't the model of efficiency, and a lot of defensive advanced stats suggested that he was bottom five in the league in defense. Like, and part of that has to do with the fact that his backup was Dennis Schroeder. You know, if his replacement is good at defense, then, you know, that makes sense. But that's really troubling, right? And then the whole Miles Turner thing compiles on itself, and Monte and Jeff Teague both not going to stop anyone. And then Miles Turner is like getting in more foul trouble, and there's no one to protect the rim. And if he's in foul trouble, then Al Jefferson is protecting your hoop. And also, your offense is still not efficient. Like, I just think it's like it's a recipe for disaster. That's
and then you bring off the bench a guy like Rodney Stuckey, who's not an efficient scorer,
right?
Either, and then you're in a bit of trouble in that sense.
Yeah. So do you see what I'm saying? Like, I said that I think they're going to be the third worst team in the East. I think it's going to be precipitous because putting aside everything you know specifically about the Pacers, right? If you are talking about a team that has maybe not a single plus efficiency player on the team, you know, Al Jefferson, maybe, you know, but Al Jefferson's got plenty of problems, right? And, you know, one good defender potentially, right? Unless they use Miles Turner effectively. So their other potential good defender is a sophomore, right? And that's shaky, right? And then they've got horrific defenders around it. If you just think about a team that has a really bad defense and they're super inefficient, that is a really bad team. You know,
I agree with you. I'm fully on board. Look, and even last season when Paul George was coming back, I'm trying to recall the tweet I did one, say August last year, saying which Eastern Conference team is set for the biggest spike in wins, and I reckon 80% of people, Pacers, they're going to win 57 games. No, they're not. Like, they're not going to do that, and they struggled, and it wasn't George, and I was wrong about George. I thought he would really, really struggle because that's a horrific injury that basically no one can come back from in that sort of time frame.
Yeah.
But he did it, but the rest of the team was still, you know, didn't live up to the sort of expectations that a lot of their fan base and a lot of the NBA, you know, sphere in general thought they would.
You know, and we'll move on from Indiana, even though I think Indiana is fascinating, and I end up talking about them a lot and Russell Westbrook a lot, and, like, you know, whatever, it's the offseason, who cares? I think the big thing that people missed the boat on with Indiana was, like, people made this assumption with Paul George as his stats really dropped off as the season went on. Like, he came out the gates really great.
That dropped significantly.
Right. And then everyone made the assumption that it was because of fatigue or just, like, a downturn. To me, it's really simple. CJ Miles was the other guy that was on the court for the first part of the season. And then in the second part of the season, it was Monte Ellis. I don't think it was fatigue at all. I think it was just simply, you know, the sapped effect of having the primary ball handler instead of Paul George with someone to kick to in the corner for three. And CJ Miles was great at the start of the season. And then, like, since he had to play four defensively, sort of got ground to a bone and he wasn't nearly as effective. But that difference was, like, huge, right? I really think that was it. Like, that was the dynamic thing, is, like, the switch from CJ Miles playing 30 to 35 minutes to Monte Ellis playing those minutes instead.
I think that that's a great point. I think that's a huge part of it. The other thing that I'll say that is part of it is that he started off well, and he just went back to what he was before. He just went back to that same sort of inefficient guy. Look, I'm sure that it's got a lot to do with that, but that's who Paul George has never been, this guy that was shooting like the lights out that he was in November. He had 1 month of doing it, and then he just went back to basically what we expect, and that's really awesome. And he had the best season of his career, but he's never been a guy who's going to be, I'm going to, you know, knock in 48% of my shots and hit 40% of my threes. It's just not who he is, and even though he did it for a month, it was always going to drop off. So he just sort of went back to normal, and the fatigue thing, it didn't really add up to me because he just went back to what, you know, who he is.
Yeah. But, you know, it is sort of a stretch to say that they're going to be worse than the Bulls. I think the Knicks are probably a playoff team. I mean, they're not, like, great, but Melo's
significant. Okay, well, let's phrase it this way then. Who drops out of the playoffs from last season?
It's not going to be the Pistons.
No. The Pacers, you've already said.
Right, yeah.
You drop out. I think the Heat probably drop out.
I've done my Western Conference 1-8. I haven't done my Eastern Conference, but
the East is hard. It's really hard to work out the end of the East.
I think the Magic are a playoff team. And then
you could say that about the Magic, you could say the Bulls, you could say the Wizards perhaps, but you got to have teams that have got to come out. So look, I think the Heat are out. I think that the Pacers, I think they probably make it, but they could be out. You could say the Hornets maybe, but I still think they're going to be really good. So all these, the Knicks might be a playoff team, the Bulls, the Wizards, the Magic, but that means you've got to have four teams drop out, and it's not going to happen.
Well, okay, so do you have a 1-8 set up?
I think I did 1-4. I think I did 1-4, and I had Charlotte temporarily at 4, but I didn't feel comfortable about it.
Do you want to see if we can reach a sort of consensus 1-8?
Okay. Well, we know who 1 is.
Okay, yeah. I assume you're talking about the 76ers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Napa know-how. Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how.
Okay, so, yeah, Cavs are first.
Yep.
Oof. It's already hard.
Yes, yeah, so I went Cleveland, Boston, Toronto, but 2 and 3 is pretty interchangeable. Okay.
Boston, and then, I mean, I don't think the Hawks are going to drop off. I think that, you know, I'm willing to buy from Dwight Howard that, so in, you know, 13-14, 12-13, and then 11-12, so in the 5 years prior to last season, Dwight Howard was better than Al Horford, right? And then last season only, Al Horford was better than Dwight. So I'm expecting Dwight to be better than Al Horford. I'm not sure what that means or if it means anything. But yeah, I could see the Hawks being better than the Raptors. I think it's going to be awfully hard to like redo what the Raptors just did.
I don't see the Hawks being better than the Raptors, but I also think that a lot of people are discounting how good Howard can be. Now, I think Horford will still be better than him, and I still think Horford's a better player, but I think that people saying, oh, Howard came in, you're going to be terrible, they're joking, because Howard's going to provide a huge amount more rim protection than what Horford did, and he's going to be a lot better rebounder than what Horford was. And the Hawks were historically bad as an offensive and defensive rebounding team last year. So he's going to help, and it changes their team around, definitely. The big key is going to be Schroeder replacing Teague, and I think that Schroeder can be better than Teague. So, yeah, there's a chance, but I don't think that they get better than Toronto.
Yeah.
Do you know that Toronto, I think, is the second youngest or third youngest team in the entire NBA?
Toronto.
Yep. I think it's Philadelphia, Portland, Toronto is the top three youngest teams.
Huh. That's interesting.
They've got that stack of young guys, DeLon Wright, Norman Powell, Bruno Caboclo, Bebe Naguera, obviously adding Jakob Poeltl, Pascal Siakam, all those guys are coming in. Look, they've got this big group of these 21 to 23-year-olds, and some of them are, Wright's not going to play much this year because of that four-month injury. Norman Powell's going to be a massive contributor for him, and he is going to be impactful on a defensive end as well. So
you said he was going to start at 3 by the end of the year and beat out.
I think there's a chance. I think there's a real chance that he does, or he'll start at 2 and DeRozan will play at 3 or whatever. But I think there's a real chance that by the end of the season, or maybe heading into next season, that Powell is starting for this team.
Yeah, he's got a 6'10" wingspan.
He's really good.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's quick. He's athletic. He's a super athlete and dunker and jumper, and he's a good shooter. He's a good scorer. He can do a lot of stuff, and he's a guy that a lot of casual NBA fans will have no idea about. He's in my list of all under the radar guys.
Yeah. I had to like look back on him, during the playoffs, the Pacers Raptors thing, and hindsight's 20/20, but his draft express or whatever, like his negatives, all seemed really kind of petty. And I was like, why did he drop that far?
Pick 46 is ludicrous. Like when I went to Summer League last year and watched him from the first game, you could just go, okay, well, this guy is going to be good. And there's something definitely happening here with this guy. So we're going to see something. I didn't know it would. And it took the Carroll injury for him to really be thrust into a bigger role. But even from the start of last season, I was like, this guy is going to have a role in this league, and it's going to be a pretty significant one.
Yeah, 46 is weird. The NBA draft is weird. Okay, so yeah, Raptors 3. Are the Hawks still 4?
I had Charlotte as four.
Look,
they did lose. I think their biggest loss is Lynn. That's a huge loss for them. Sessions does not make up for that. But yeah, it was tough for me to get that four seed. I could have had Atlanta there. That was my other option.
Yeah, I don't get Rimmel and Sessions. I don't get how some people who I really respect and think are smart and know a lot about the NBA, I don't get why they like him, because I think it's black and white that he's bad.
Can't shoot. He can dish the ball a little bit, and from a fantasy point of view, when he gets minutes, he racks up a lot of assists, but he's not good.
Yeah, but I mean, like, some people think he's good. I mean, I don't know. I don't get it. You know, I think on your last podcast, you made the point that Cody Zeller is really underrated. I do hope, like, he gets more minutes at the five. I just think, and this is another thing that actually Kid Gilchrist talked about on his podcast with Woj, or Woj asked him, what do you think about all these people being like, hey, how are you going to fit into this offense? Because, like, it's all about taking threes. Like, do you think you're going to be able to cut it? Like, do you think that you're being phased out? And Michael Kidd-Gilchrist said that, oh, I just respond to it by being like, I guess there's going to be, like, an open lane for me to get to the basket then. I think that's fair, you know?
Anyone who comes up with a take that Kidd-Gilchrist it sucks because he can't shoot, then I automatically discount their opinion, because it's not right. For a start, he hasn't hit under 45% of his field goals in a season ever, so that's efficient. And I preach this a lot, that he does what he knows that he can do. He's not Tony Roden, who thinks he can hit shots from anywhere with three guys on him, spin move, fade away, three pointers. Kidd-Gilchrist. Yeah, look.
Tony Roden's had a tough go at it, man. You know.
he is one of the worst players in the NBA recently. But I do feel sorry for him. He's copped it really, really hard. You know, getting cut on Christmas Day, you know, the ACL, the New York thing. It was all really weird. But he could go to China and he will average 40, 10, and 15 in China. He should go and do that. But he's a real bad NBA player. But Kidd-Gilchrist. I'll ask you a question on the spot. You might have even heard me talk about this. How many three-point attempts did Michael Kidd-Gilchrist take in 2014-15?
I think he averaged 0.2.
In 2014-15, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist attempted zero three-pointers.
Oh, okay.
Zero. Did not attempt one.
I was last year.
You're almost there. Last year he played seven games.
Okay.
Right? And he took seven three-point attempts. He hit three of them. So 43%, that's obviously an extraordinarily small sample size, but I don't care about what he hit. I care about the fact that he felt comfortable taking them. In his entire NBA career, his entire career, he'd played 192 games, and he'd attempted 18 three-point shots. Last year, he had seven games for seven shots. That, to me, is a sign of, you know what, I can hit these now. I'm comfortable taking them. I'm comfortable in my position in the offense. We will see him taking three-point shots this year, and we'll see him hitting them at not less than 30%. He's not going to be a terrible three-point shooter. And if he can start doing that, then he's one of the best five perimeter defenders.
If he can get back to where he was in the first half of his season in Kentucky, like, he'll be good. You know, like, I mean, he'll be acceptable, you know. It's weird. It dropped off. I mean, like, he could shoot in high school. I think he will. I mean, to me... You have to make the argument that Michael Kidd-Gilchrist isn't like one of those guys who's just iron-willed, you know, because it's one of those things that I think is observable and sort of self-evident, you know. And so I think that it's one of those things where it's like, okay, if you like lay out the evidence, I'll believe that he's not. But it certainly seems to me he's the type of guy who can overcome that, you know what I mean?
I think he's going to be really good. And you're basically replacing Courtney Lee with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, and I think that's a win.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And there are lineups for the Hornets. I would probably give it to the Hornets over the Hawks, too. There are lineups for the Hornets that, can Gilchrist sort of be the rim protector if Kaminsky is marginally at the five?
He's not a terrible rim protector. He's not great, but yeah, he can definitely rebound as a five. He's a really, really good rebounder. So I think that he can switch in there for short amounts of time. Yeah,
with Batum at the three, that would be fine, right?
But they've also got Zeller and Hibbert as well. So the chances, like the need for
Hibbert. Oh, they have Hibbert. Okay, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so going to be great. Hibbert's great.
He's not going to. Hibbert can come in. But in 17 minutes, Hibbert can come in and do stuff defensively. Like, he doesn't need to play a big role. And he's not going to play a big role, but he can come in and do what he needs to do, defend, not get worn out. And you're playing him in a really small role, and I think it's going to suit him.
Yeah, I'm skeptical, but it wouldn't knock my socks off if he looked a lot better, not against starting centers, you know, and starting guards for that matter, you know.
I'm expecting him to score about 5 points a game. So it's more just getting in there and being a 7'3" guy that is, by all statistical views, a really terrible rebounder. But again, this comes back to that point you were making at the start about, you know, the crossover between fantasy and real life, and people will look at him and go, the man's 7'3" and he goes out and gets 4 rebounds a game. It doesn't matter, because he makes everybody around him a better rebounder, because he puts his body there and he blocks 2 guys out, and then Kid Gilchrist comes over the top and grabs the board, and then Zeller can come in, and then Kaminsky can come in, and then Kemba Walker's a really good rebounder, and Batum, and Hibbert just blocks guys out so everyone else can grab a rebound.
Yeah,
that's where his value is.
I had a really big article. A lot of people read it and didn't realize it was me, but I broke down the uncontested rebounds symptom of Paul George and Lance Stephenson on that old Hibbert team. And that got a lot of traction. And it actually, I think it sort of started this thing with like the Lance Stephenson stat padding thing, because I probably haven't researched anything more than that. I'm just not sure if Hibbert's there anymore. But again, if he is, I'm willing to accept that that might be a possibility. I'm not going to assume it, you know.
Yeah, that's fair enough. He doesn't really have the benefit of the doubt over the last few years, but I think that's one thing that he can do, is provide an ability for the team to get better on the glass.
This is totally just jumping somewhere else, but that sort of prompted me. What do you think about Julius Okafor?
I'm not a big fan of his. I wasn't a big fan of his coming into the league. You know, initial impressions, they stick a lot. And when I saw him playing in summer league, he just looked a step slow. And I've just got no confidence in him being able to really hit any sort of shot that wasn't a post move or a close-in shot. Now, he did improve that a little bit last season. His defense was probably piled on a bit more than what it should have been. He wasn't as bad as what people were making him out to be, but that doesn't mean that he was good. The scoring is decent, but I just worry about how he fits. I think that he fits in a Al Jefferson now sort of role. Let's play 23 minutes off the bench. He fits as Enes Kanter, basically. I think that's what he is, a guy that plays 24 minutes and goes for 14-9.
Yeah, I just I can't help but feel like you're asking a lot out of a rookie big to carry the offense on one end and then on defense just be acceptable, even, you know. Like, I mean, metrics wise he was the worst defensive center in the league, and there's almost no arguing about it in every significant way. It's not even that Noel was his backup, like, even in not on off stuff, and it's just like straight rim protection stuff, he was really bad. But I just feel like the NCAA season is not as long. I mean, with all that's made about, like, you don't really know what it takes to be a professional until you're a professional athlete, you know, I just feel like NBA conditioning, coming right out of college, and, like, you know, posting up is hard too, you know? And
the dude's 20 years old. He's got a lot of room to grow.
Yeah, I just feel like, based on how good he was in college and the fact that he was playing really a totally different role, he was playing, like, a lot of his comparisons were Tim Duncan, because he played, like, early Tim Duncan, though, because, like, he played up at the top left of the key, right, and was a playmaker. He averaged, like, 4 assists or something like that. He was really effective in that role. And I think, like, symptomatically, he wasn't posting up 10 times a game in college. He was doing it every once in a while, right? It was more of a face-up and then sort of, you know, weird Tim Duncan-y type style, like flipping it up and using crazy footwork and doing that whole thing from the top of the key. He had to totally shift his game because there was no other way of creating offense on the 76ers. And, like, I think the fact that he was, like, acceptable is, like, pretty impressive.
Yeah, look, that's interesting that you bring up Tim Duncan as a comp for him. when I guess I was looking at a lot of the statistical translations and statistical comps, and Tim Duncan came up basically as two of the top four for Karl Anthony Towns. But when I did Jahlil Okafor's ones, the ones that came up were like tractor trailer. That was the sort of player that come up as the top comparison for Jahlil Okafor.
Yeah, but that's sort of my point, is that I think the statistics don't bear out anything the right way, because I think that he just like wasn't playing in his most effective eventual role, you know?
Yeah, look, the roles were a mess. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Do you like Dario Saric and Simmons next to each other?
Yeah. Yes, I think Saric can play the three a little bit. I don't think Simmons can, but I think Saric can play a little bit at the three. So, yeah, but I don't think you want to start them and play them 20 minutes next to each other, but I think you could play them 10 or 15 and then stagger them a little bit in a similar role to each other.
I just feel like if you develop them side by side, the 76ers would eventually have the best transition offense in the league, right?
Their ball movement, assuming they can get some sort of point guard, but their ball movement from the three and the four will be almost the best, almost the best in the league.
Yeah, they're like crazy on the break. I just feel like maybe it's like one of those things where you have to do it just so they can develop chemistry, but it's maybe not a good short-term decision. We'll see what happens with Colangelo. I don't really know.
I think a lot of people need to... And this is a complete different direction here, but we're talking about Saric and the Olympics coming up. USA is going to win the gold, and they're going to destroy every team. But the most fun that I think people can get from it's fun watching DeMar DeRozan trying to throw down in-game 360s. That's fun. But watching the countries.
I'm with Coach K on that. I think that.
Don't do it.
Like basketball's not supposed to be fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What we need to do when watching the Olympics is watch Serbia, watch Croatia, watch Hezonja and Saric play together. Watch Nikola Jokic, because that is where the interest is going to come. Watch Rudy Gobert play for France. Watch some of these guys, especially Saric, especially Hezonja, especially Jokic, these guys that people may not know about, but they're really, really good, and that's going to be the interesting thing to see those guys perform.
You can watch your guy, Evan Fournier, play for...
He's not playing.
Oh, God.
that is a ludicrous decision from France. It is just ridiculous.
There's got to be a French joke here. Let me think. Eiffel Tower. I don't know. Whatever. We don't have to get nationalist. It's kind of nuts. I mean,
it's a ridiculous decision.
Man, I wish I had pulled off that joke better, you know, because like, I did pull it back. It's like I knew that he wasn't selected. I was not decisive enough. That was my problem with that joke right there. I break down my jokes in light of time. Anyways, let's go ahead and stop here. I took notes about fantasy basketball, and we just ran all over the place. It's like the off season. This is what you're supposed to do, right?
Yep, just talk. Whatever comes into your head.
Yeah, I mean, that was cool. I feel like you probably already broke down how star moves change the other people on their team stats, you know?
Pretty much, yep.
Yeah. Sleepers. Yeah.
I haven't really done a huge, because I'm still doing all the projections at the moment, so I haven't come up with all that sort of, because I don't know how it's all going to pan out, so it's hard for me to come in and say I think this guy's going to be a sleeper, but then when I release all the projections it turns out that he's not, because I just don't know how. I'm halfway through doing that at the moment, so it's hard for me to get into all that sort of stuff now until I've got a full set of results in front of me.
But hey, you'll come back on, right?
Definitely. Yep.
You had a lovely time, I can tell. You don't even have to say anything about it. I'm just like, I'm reading it loud and clear. You know, this is all audio, but he's applauding me. He actually just stood up out of his chair, and he's giving me a standing ovation. That's what's happening live right now, is Josh just like clapping for me.
Yeah, I just muted the microphone when the clapping was on because I didn't want it to be too raucous and too loud as I was doing it.
That's professional right there.
Exactly. Hit the cough button.
Well, thank you. You know, you can hold the applause until we finish the podcast, and you can fade it out with that. You know, that's been Josh Lloyd, everyone, here just talking basketball, you know, just hanging out, doing off-season nothingness. You know, got to appreciate it. Got to appreciate how amazing his... Man, is it still the Red Rock fantasy thing, or it's just totally locked on fantasy?
Just in spirit. It's Red Rock in spirit. It's locked on in name.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Is it also locked on in spirit? Is it like a double spirit thing?
Yeah, it's full of spirit. It's all spirit. It's spilling out the sides.
Okay, yeah. So it has two spirits in one name.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. But you just need to remember the name. You can be filled with the spirit just by listening. And if you know the name and you search it on the internet, you can find it. And it is Locked On Fantasy Basketball, and it's on the Locked On Podcast Network. I've been talking about how impressive, really ambitious, and like...
Very.
It's going pretty well.
Yeah, I think we've got about... I think we've got 23 or 24 of the NBA teams covered. We've got, obviously, a fantasy show. We've got a Locked On NBA, which David hosts as well. And I think we've got about 8 NFL teams and a Locked On NFL and a Locked On Fantasy Football as well. And by the middle of September, we should have all teams covered.
Yeah. I thought about... I'm from Dallas. I thought about doing that, but, like, Almighty Ballin is a full-time job.
So, yeah.
You know? I mean,
I can,
running...
I can relate to that.
Yeah. Damn. So, anyways... Hey, Twitter, right? Facebook, whatever you're working on right now. I know you're working on projections and stuff. Are you just sort of like, as you finish those, you're putting them up?
No, we do them all together because they all sort of tie into each other because people love seeing them all as a rankings list. So the Basketball Monster site will be open no later than the 1st of September. It'll probably be earlier than that. We'll have all the projections up there, which will constantly get tweaked. Plus, we'll have a stack of articles going up there. Plus, the podcast is going and continuing to go. And also had a piece go up on Hardwood Paroxysm about Cameron Payne a couple of days ago as well.
Yeah, cool. Hardwood Paroxysm. I really like them. I always get in arguments with that guy on Twitter. Whoever's running their
Matt.
Twitter account, fight
me. Matt Moore, yeah.
Tell him Matt, that I would fight him.
he's a really good guy. He's a you know Matt Moore. He's the guy from CBS Sports.
Yeah. I just that's him. Is he the one running the H Paroxysm, like at H Paroxysm?
HP Basketball. That's him. Yeah, because he started Hardwood Paroxysm. He doesn't write there anymore.
He subtweeted me because I said that he was like, if the Timberwolves get Ben Simmons, then the rest of the league should just go into a bunker for 4 years. And then I replied, as long as that bunker is further away than the three-point line, I think that they'll be fine because, like, there would be no spacing there. And then after that, a couple minutes later, he tweeted, I can't wait till NBA Twitter figures out that there's more to basketball than spacing. And then he was a hashtag maybe one day. I was not happy about it.
Yeah, he loves a Twitter argument.
Yeah. I think I actually replied, fight me. So maybe we can have a duel of the voice. And hey, next time you come on, I'll like actually build an itinerary. Because like, I thought that I wanted to go through fantasy stuff and I didn't. Normally a lot more structured. But hey, anyways, did you say your Twitter?
Yeah, I said it at the start, but I'll say it again. It's redrock_bball.
Yeah, and follow him. He's a lovely Twitterer. He does all the best tweets. He's great at tweeting. That's, I would say, like a top 5 talent, at least.
I'd say top 40%, maybe. I'm not that great at Twitter. I occasionally have a decent tweet, but I'm average, maybe slightly above average with tweeting. But hey, don't let that stop you from following me.
Oh no, I was more implying that you're like so far below average at everything else.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Boom. Knockout. Anyways, okay, I've dragged on this outro for way too long. Luckily, you know, I edit my audio and you, the listener, are hearing this now and just now discovering, wait, I missed all of this bullshit. Yeah, that's right, you did miss it. It was smooth and clean, but just trust me, you know, this outro wasn't nearly as great as it is right now because the podcast is officially over right now. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Chris.
Cool beans.
Cool.